Well, good morning. I want to greet all of you who normally come to our second service that are here in the first because you were afraid that we would not let you out in time to get home for the ACC tournament. And I know how you think, and I would be doing the exact same thing. I have to tell you, I actually have to admit that for the sake of the unity of this church, I am grateful that it wasn't both UNC and Duke that made it to the final game. Not saying I'm, you know, publicly preferring one over the other. I'm just saying that's always bad for the unity of our church on a day like today because you look at each other suspect. So I'm glad. And I was hoping to see in worship somebody do the Tyler Hansbrough dance in the choir this morning, that little thing he taught us yesterday. We are a church that meets in two different locations. We are a church that meets at Briar Creek, a campus, and also one at Cole Mill. And for the last few weeks, our Cole Mill campus, who is watching us by video, has been a week delayed in the service. They've been doing the sermon from the previous week, but this week they are live again, and so we welcome you guys back up with us. Next week, as I hope you all realize, is Easter Sunday, and it is a huge Sunday for our church, and you're going to be hearing more about it at the end of the service, but just suffice it to say, listen, I am asking you if it is at all possible that you make plans that you can be here on Sunday. I know Easter is a great time to travel, but Easter is that Sunday where a lot of people are willing to come to church, and we want everybody to bring somebody, neighbors, people that where you eat, you know, lunch. If you got a waitress or a waiter that commonly serves your table, make sure you're just inviting them and bringing them. We always tailor that service. We try to have every service so that it's accessible for people who don't know anything about Christianity, but especially on Easter Sunday, that's what we're really thinking about and focusing on. So if you can, make plans to be here with us next week, and you'll hear more about it at the end of the service, okay? All right, well, let's get right into this today because we have a lot of ground to cover. We're going to talk about Judas's betrayal of Jesus. I'm going to read to you almost all of Mark 14 because I think it's important that we get our minds around the whole chapter. So Mark chapter 14, if you have a Bible, if not, it'll be on the screen here behind me. You can follow along. I will be jumping around a little bit, so I'll try to keep you up with me if I can. Mark 14, verse 3, and while he, that being Jesus, was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly. Now, nard probably doesn't sound to you like it's very appealing, but it's not lard, it's nard. It was like a perfume. She broke the flask, and she poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves, other gospel writers tell us that that some is primarily Judas, who said indignantly, why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they scolded her. Verse 6, but Jesus said, leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? Because she has done a beautiful thing to me. Jump down to verse 10. Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, right after this, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And they sought then an opportunity to betray him. All right, fast forward a little bit, go down to verse 18. As they were reclining at the table, Jesus and his disciples for the Passover, and they were eating, Jesus said, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. One of you who is eating with me now. And they began to be sorrowful and to say to him one after another, Lord, is it I? He said to them, it is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. It would have been better for that man if he had not ever been born. Okay, fast forward again. Now, verse 27. Jesus said to them, the disciples that is, you will all fall away. Peter said to him, even though they all fall away, I will not. And Jesus said to him, truly, I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. But Peter said emphatically, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And they all said the same. Verse 32, and so they went to a place called Gethsemane. Verse 43, and Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Verse 45, and when he came, he went up to him at once and said, Rabbi, and he kissed him, and they laid hands on him, and they seized him. Verse 50, and they all left him, and they fled. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth around his body, and they seized him. Verse 52, but he left the linen cloth, and he ran away naked, this man, this strange, mysterious man that he is referring to. A lot of times, I think we tend to see Judas as a really bad person that did something that none of us would ever dream of actually doing. But what I want to do is I want to try to show you today that that is not at all true. All right, first of all, this whole passage is written in a way to show those of us who consider ourselves to be Jesus' friends, maybe even his closest disciples, are not really that far from what Judas did. The way the whole passage is set up is designed to show you that. Let me show that to you. Verse 18, Jesus tells them that someone will betray him. What's a little strange is that he is so ambiguous about it, right? He doesn't come in and say, one of you will betray me. And there he is, right there, and point him out, right? The reason that he's doing that is because he wants each of his disciples to look into their own hearts. So he says, one of you will betray me. Who is it? Right, the word that Jesus uses for betray in Greek language, which is, of course, the language the New Testament was written in, means literally to sell. One of you is going to sell me. He's saying one of you for the right price is going to sell me. Look into your hearts. Watch their response. It's actually pretty shaky and uncertain. Verse 19, they all begin to say, is it I? I mean, you can see the whole ambiguity of the thing. Greek scholars tell us that that phrase, the way that that question is phrased back to Jesus, reveals an unbelievable amount of uncertainty and ambivalence. It's almost as if they're saying, it's not I, is it? Is it I? Is it me, Lord? They're uncertain. Now, of course, the traitor that Jesus is specifically referring to in verse 18 is Judas. But in verse 27, Jesus explains to them, it's not just Judas. No, you will all fall away. All of you will fail me. All of you have a price at which you will sell me, something that you would esteem of higher value than me. So don't think that Judas is actually that much different than you. It reminded me of the story of the famous story about Winston Churchill, where as he was trying to lead Great Britain into the Second World War, he had some political enemies, one in particular, a lady that was in the royal family. And in the midst of an argument where he was trying to explain that it was the right thing to do to go in and try to stop Hitler, this woman said, it's just not worth the price that we would have to pay. And he looked at her in public, you know, in a dinner setting, and he said, ma'am, he said, if I gave you £1 million right now, would you sleep with me? And she was sort of taken back at the question a little bit, and she said, well, he said, no, just answer the question. She said, for £1 million, I suppose I might. He said, I have £25 in my pocket right now. Would you sleep with me for £25? And she said, no, sir, I am not a prostitute. And he responded to her by saying, we already established your identity. I just wanted to know what your price was. What Jesus was trying to say to Judas or to the disciples are, don't think he's altogether different. Yeah, the pricing may be a little different, but the same thing that is in Judas is in you. All of you have a price, which is exactly what happened in verse 50. They all left him and fled. And the most outspoken of them, Peter, the one that said, I would never sell you, will even deny even knowing him. The last scene, verses 51 and 52, are particularly peculiar. Right? It says a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. And honestly, how many of you have thought before, why is that in there? Right? I mean, you get this little pornographic scene right at the end. Like, what did that add to it? All right, here's what N.T. Wright, I think he's exactly right, says about this. He says, what you're supposed to think, here you've got a man who is one of Jesus' disciples that is fleeing from the garden from the presence of Jesus naked. It's supposed to take your mind back to the Garden of Eden, where God's friend, Adam and Eve, had fled from his presence naked. And what it's showing you is that here in the Garden of Gethsemane, it's not that the Judases have failed Jesus, it's that everybody has failed Jesus. All of us have sinned. And all of us essentially are the same as Judas. He has been loyal to us, Jesus has been, and we've all left him. Now you see, in between all this, in the middle of this chapter, is where he gives them the Last Supper, in which he explains to them that the purpose of his death is to die for sin. So I want you to get this. The explanation that he gives of why he is going to die is surrounded by the disciples' betrayal. It's incredibly important. Because he is showing them that it's not just evil out there that he's dying for. It's not like Nero or Pilate or Herod that he's just dying for. It's for those of us who consider ourselves to be his friends. The evil in the world that Jesus is dying for is not just in people like Judas, right? It's in people like us. You see, in the end, all of us have left and fled. All of us have had a price. For some of us, it's been a little mockery by our friends, and so you back down on the way that you let people know that you're a follower of Jesus. For some of you, it's your unwillingness to go overseas. I'll do anything, Jesus, but don't ask me or my kids to go over there. For some of you, you're mad at Jesus because he didn't answer your prayers. Or maybe you compromise your commitment to him for the sake of ambition. It's just some small price. You're not supposed to read this story, you see, and say, woe is Judas. You're supposed to read it and say, woe is me. You see, we have a tendency to see the problem of evil as something that is out there. It's Judas. The problem with the world is people like Judas. And sometimes we have a tendency to look at whole groups of people as the source of evil. Oh, it's the radical Muslims. They're the ones who are causing all the problems in the world. Or I remember when I grew up, it wasn't the radical Muslims at that point, it was the Russians. Right? The Russians, they're the ones who put the world in danger, and they thought the same thing about us, and it was the Russians. And now we've just got a new axis of evil, right? You listen to some politicians, and they say it's the rich people who are causing all the problems. Others say, no, it's the poor, uneducated people. Republicans think it's the Democrats. Democrats think it's the Republicans. The Bible never divides people into groups that are fundamentally good or bad like that. See, what it's saying is that if you look clearly enough, the evil of Judas is in each of us. The philosopher Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it like this, and I love this. He said, the dividing line of good and evil is not between countries, it's not between cultures, it's within each of our hearts. Now you say, okay, we're all sinners. Duh, okay, that's Sunday School 101. But listen, if you really believe that, it would completely change your attitude toward others. Right, one prominent psychologist that I heard said that if people could overcome their resentment and their anger, then that would take care of the majority of the problems that brought people into his office for psychological counseling. Because most people are angry because they feel like they have been wounded, they have been sinned against. If I were to ask you, how many of you have a recurring anger problem? If you traced it down enough, it's because somebody has done something against you and you're angry about it. You ever notice that we're not near as angry at our own sin as we are about the sin that people do to us? Right, somebody lies to you and they're just a filthy liar that can't be trusted, right? But when you lie, oh, well, you got reasons. You're complicated. You know, I mean, you, if people understood the pressures that you were under, they would have understood why you lied right there, right? You don't see others the same way you see yourself. Miroslav Volf, the Croatian, I think he's at Princeton or Yale One, who witnessed the genocide of thousands of his own people, said this, listen, forgiveness flounders. I can't do it. Because I exclude my enemy from the company of humans, and I exclude myself from the company of sinners. We don't see other people as subject to the same forces that we are subject to, and we don't see ourselves as bad as other people. It is only through seeing yourself as being radically infected with sin that you see yourself as radically indebted to God's grace. Seeing yourself in this way will change your attitude toward others. For example, say that you and a friend decided to rob a bank. All right, so you get your plan together, you get your weapons together, and on the day that you're going to do it, you decide you want to include another one of your friends, so you stop by his house to try to see if you can persuade him to go along with you. And when you get there, he says, guys, don't do this. This is crazy. And you say, no, we're going to do it. And you say, come with us. And he says, no, I won't come with you, and I won't let you go. And you turn around to leave. And he goes up, and he grabs the two of you that are going to do it by the back of your shirt. All right, your shirt, because it's cheaply made, or your friend's shirt, because it's cheaply made, rips, and he walks out, and your friend can't hold on to him. But yours, it doesn't rip, and he manages to hold you and hold you down so that you can't go do it. So your friend goes alone to rob the bank. In the midst of the robbery, he gets caught. He ends up killing a guard and getting sentenced to life in prison. Now, I want you to imagine that you went to visit that friend in prison. What would your attitude be toward him? Your intent was exactly the same as your friend's intent. It was somebody else who held you back that caused you not to go down that path. You see, when the Bible talks about our sin, it always talks about it in those terms. Because it's saying that God is the one who held us back. God was gracious to us. That changes my attitude toward other people. You know, our own community the last couple weeks has just been absolutely rocked by the tragic murder of Eve Carson at Chapel Hill. You know, they've apprehended a couple of guys in that case, and some have suspected it was a gang initiation. And it makes a lot of people angry. And people ask themselves, how could people be so evil? Something, or I heard something this week that actually changed my perspective on it a little bit. You know that part of our mission to our city is we have adopted a elementary school, a public elementary school, with Eastway Elementary. And for the last few years, we've been very involved in that, and we consider that, in a sense, our school. We just want to take care of it. We want to try to bless it. And this week, one of our pastors met with the principal, and the principal told him, she was very upset. She said, we've now got 64 homeless kids that go to our elementary school. They live in a shelter, or, you know, they're in a foster home or something like that. And so Chris, the pastor, presented to our worship ministry. He said, look, we've said this is our school. That means that these are our homeless kids. What are we going to do about that? Well, one of our choir members, in fact, I think he's back there, Jim Hill, is also a district court judge. And Jim Hill stood up and he said, you know, we've got to take this seriously. He said, because the people that I see coming through my courtroom that commit the crimes like the two guys are suspected of committing are the ones who were homeless in these elementary schools growing up. And because they have the absence of that type of home, they resort to this type of behavior later. Now, I'm not trying to exonerate or excuse or say that these guys should not be held responsible for their unbelievable crime. I'm simply trying to say that the fact that I grew up in a home, that I was taught the ways of God, the fact that I know Jesus really has nothing to do with me. I am every bit the same as every murderer in the world. It's simply the things in my life I could not control that God put in my life. I am a product of grace, not a product of great decisions. And it changes your perspective, you see, to people on the outside, because it's all been of grace. All right? Now you're ready to look at Judas. You see, once you've seen that you have a Judas inside of you, I want to look more closely now at why he betrayed Jesus. Because again, I think if you look rightly, you'll probably see yourself. All right? First of all, lots of great leaders have been betrayed, right? Jesus is not unique in that. But usually the person who does the betraying wants to take the place of the leader. But there's no evidence of that with Judas. There's no evidence that he wants to be the Messiah or thinks he can be. Sometimes people betray their leader for a great sum of money. But 30 pieces of silver is not that much money. And in fact, Judas even throws it all back after it's over. It's not just the money. It wasn't simply 30 pieces of silver that he wanted to get a hold of. Sometimes we think of Judas like he's this awful demon-possessed hypocrite. Like he's the guy that's sneaking around worshiping Satan. You know, when the other disciples are out praying or listening to Jesus, he's out back sacrificing a gerbil or a cat or something. And, you know, and that's just what Judas is. He's got little horns on his head when you look at him. But that's not really true. He wasn't a hypocrite. Judas, like many in Israel, sincerely believed that Jesus was the Messiah. In fact, Judas, get this, was the one who was selected to carry the group's purse. Now, what does that tell you? Who would you select to carry your purse? The guy that you would think is responsible and trustworthy, right? You don't choose as your accountant the shady guy who cheated his way through college, right? I mean, you know, it reminds me of the Seinfeld, where Seinfeld is all obsessed because his accountant has a sniffle and he thinks he's got to be doing drugs with the money he's given him. Have you seen that one? It's like 10 of you that have seen that? Well, you know, you just don't want your accountant to be shady. Judas is not shady. Judas is the most responsible, trustworthy guy in the group. He's all around a great, sincere guy. He would have been elected president of the student body. He would have been probably a candidate to be the pastor of their first church. So what's going on with Judas? What you'll see is that Judas was disappointed with Jesus. He had expectations about the Messiah that had not been met. He was like most Jews, you see, who assumed four things about the Messiah. Let me give them to you, okay? And I got to do this quickly. All right, so buckle up here. All right, here's the first thing he assumed about the Messiah. Judas wanted a Messiah who would punish evil. Jewish people, you see, in the Bible times were the poor and the oppressed. And the Romans were the ones that were doing the poor, were making them poor and were oppressing them. And they were under bondage to the Romans, so they were waiting for a Messiah who would come and would just let the Romans have it. Let's just say it like that. All right, and make them all rich again. And they were downright excited about the return of the Messiah. In the first place where Jesus really declares himself to be the Messiah, it's in Luke 4. Luke 4, not 4, but 4, but not 4, okay? He tells them, okay, and I quote, I'll put it up here for you. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And the Jewish people are thinking, that's us? It says, in fact, in verse 22 of that chapter, that they all spoke well of him. They all went up, put their hands on his back, and said, that's awesome, Jesus. We've been waiting on you for a long time. Bring it on. Get it going. All right? Exalt God's people. Put down the Romans. But then Jesus all of a sudden does something completely unexpected. He goes on to explain that in Israel's history, God has always shown compassion to the people that Israel considered to be outsiders. Okay, so you see, as he goes on with his sermon, he explains in the days of Elijah, right, when there was a famine, did you know that the only person, Jesus said, that God showed mercy to was a widow from the region of Sidon in Zarephath? Now, that doesn't mean anything to you, but for Jews, that was the place where all the bad people lived. That's like saying this woman, like I've told you before, had clear heels and worked at Hooters. This is not the kind of person you'd think is a righteous person. And that's the only one, though, that God showed mercy to. Then he goes on and he said, and then you think about the time in Israel where all these lepers, and God chose, the only person he healed of leprosy was Naaman, who was the head of the army that had wreaked havoc on Israel. That'd be like saying today it's the Mujahideen commander is the only one that God selected to show mercy to. You see, Judas wanted a Messiah that would come and punish evil. Jesus, on the other hand, showed grace to outsiders. This was an irritating pattern in Jesus' life. He was always showing compassion to people Jews considered to be bad, like Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, who taxed people and extorted people to take up money for the Roman army who was oppressing the Jews. Right, that was like the scum of the earth to the Jews. And Jesus is showing mercy to him. Then you've got the woman at the well from the racist Samaritan clan. Jesus shows mercy to her. Then you got the woman caught in adultery. That pattern made them mad. And it made him so mad, in fact, that in Luke 4, the very guy that they patted on the back and spoken well of and said, what a great Messiah you're going to be, it says in one of my favorite little incidents in the Gospels, it says they rose up and drove him out of the town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built so they could throw him down off the cliff. This is great. Watch verse 30. But passing through their midst, he went away. You know, I get the image. You ever watch these Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd, you know, fights where all of a sudden there's a big dust cloud and then Bugs Bunny just walks out and Elmer Fudd's left fighting himself? That's the image I get when I read this passage right here, is that they're all done. Jesus just kind of walks out and is like, all right, I'll take off. I'm going to see you guys later. All right, but they're so angry. Why are they so angry? It made them angry because when you are a rule follower and you think that you're righteous, nothing makes you madder than the idea that God loves someone who didn't follow the rules just as much as you did. Right? All right, it brings me to number two. Judas wanted a Messiah who would reward righteous rule-keeping. But Jesus taught that true righteousness was more than rule-keeping. Keeping rules is not enough, he says. No, it's got to do with your heart, what you love. In fact, in one of Jesus' first sermons, he began to explain. He says, the law says you shouldn't murder. And everybody was like, check. Never murder. He says, but I'm going to say to you that it's not enough you don't murder. You don't get angry at people without a cause, and you love them like you love yourself. And all of a sudden, they were like, he says, the law says you shouldn't commit adultery. And they're like, check, never committed adultery. And Jesus said, but I'm telling you, what I say to you is it's a matter of the heart. If you've ever looked on a woman with lust in your heart, then you're guilty of the sin in God's eyes of adultery. And they were like, not so sure anymore. The law said obey the Ten Commandments, but I say to you, love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. You see, Jesus redefined righteousness. He said it's not enough that you act righteously, but you got to love righteousness. You have to want righteousness. You have to do it entirely because you love God and love others. And that left them in a hopeless dilemma. You see, it attacked their pride. And rather than see themselves as sinners who could only fall on Jesus' grace, they killed Jesus so they could avoid the law rather than letting him be judged for it in their place. Because the one thing religious people hardly ever want to give up is their pride. Number three, Judas wanted a political Messiah who would give power to rule. But Jesus taught that the salvation we needed was not political, so he didn't focus on political power. You know, several times throughout Jesus' life, they tried to make him king. But Jesus knew that you couldn't coerce love. Right? You can't command love. Did you ever have your parents try to convince you why you should, before you got married, marry somebody else? Or, you know, like here's the girl that you should be dating and marrying. Did that ever happen to you, or is that just me? And they laid out a really logical case, and they were, with all the parental pressure they could exert, they were telling you this is who you ought to be attracted to. But yeah, you can see, I see it works out on paper. I see the logic behind it. It just doesn't work. Right? You can't tell my heart what to love. My heart just loves what it loves. Jesus knew you couldn't make people love God. So you can't save people by coercing them to simply obey rules. So Jesus did not use his power to gain political power. He used his power to love and serve people because he knew that's how their hearts would be won to him to love them. Number four, Judas wanted a Messiah who would reward them with power and riches. Jesus taught that he was the real reward of the kingdom. In verses 3 through 6 that I read to you in chapter 14 of Mark, you see a very revealing incident that tells you something very important about Judas. This woman named Mary, which we find out her name in John 12, she comes in and she anoints Jesus' feet. Now, in those days, the feet of somebody after walking in the dust all day are extremely filthy. And so, yes, you're doing a service to your guest by washing their feet for them. But this is a little over the top because Mary, first of all, she's a woman with a very sordid past. And she comes in and it says that she takes this bottle of perfume that is valued 300 denarii, somewhere around $10,000. And she breaks this bottle of perfume over his feet. I've never owned a $10,000 bottle of perfume. I don't know if I've ever heard of a $10,000 bottle of perfume. If you have, don't pass that information on to my wife. As far as I'm concerned, those things don't exist. But here you got $10,000 worth of perfume, and she breaks it over Jesus' feet. She washes his feet with her tears, and she dries his feet with her hair. Judas cannot understand that. In fact, he is outraged. In John's account of this, it says he literally snorted with indignance. He snorted at it. He's like, what is that? In a sermon on this event, Jonathan Edwards said the thing that is shocking about Mary's act was its total uselessness. All right, listen to this. Think about it. It was useless to Jesus because Jesus did not need that expensive of an anointing. Right? I mean, a $500 bottle of perfume would have been sufficient. It was useless to Jesus for that amount of money to be poured out on his feet, which would be gone within a day. It was useless to Mary because Mary, you see, Jesus had already proved his love to Mary. Mary, it was her brother that Jesus had raised from the dead because he loved the family, right? She already had the promise of his love. It was useless to her. It was simply an outpouring of love on Jesus. And now you see the difference between Mary and Judas, which is the contrast chapter 14 sets up. For Judas, Jesus is a means to an end. He thinks, if I follow Jesus, then he'll give me power and riches. Judas finds Jesus useful. Mary finds Jesus beautiful. She's so overwhelmed at his love and his grace to them that she freely gives up all she has for him. Judas served Jesus to get something from him. Mary served Jesus just to get more of him. And so Judas says, if he is not going to give me the riches and power and health and wealth, then what good is he? And Mary says, were the whole realm of nature mine, that would be a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe. Mary understands the gospel. Judas, you see, is the consummate religious person. Now, before I draw that tight for you, let me just go back through these four things really quickly and show you that Judas is not far off from the average person that I think that sits in a church. All right, the first thing we saw, look, is that Judas wanted a Messiah who would punish evil. But Jesus gave grace to outsiders. All right, and you look at these four things, look at this. We are much more concerned about justice than we are mercy. You ever have somebody that you dislike so much that you don't really want God to show him mercy? Right? I'll take that nervous chuckle from a few of you as an affirmative on behalf of all of you. Right? Yes. It's a spouse that's hurt you. It's somebody that's, I mean, for some of us it may be a bigger enemy. It's the Taliban. I don't want Jesus to show mercy on the Taliban who killed, or, you know, the people who flew a plane into the World Trade Center, right? You think about these two guys that killed this girl, you think that's not the kind of people that we want to see mercy showed to. Jesus is just as irritating today because he's always picking out these people and showing grace and mercy to them and giving to them what they don't deserve. Right? Look at the second thing there. He wanted a Messiah who would reward righteous rule-keeping. And Jesus said, no, it's not rule-keeping. It's something in the heart. We have this story all the time in our church. I hear this more times than I can tell you. People are like, I grew up in church. This is the first time I've ever understood the gospel is coming to this church. Well, growing up in church, I knew all about a quiet time. I knew how to do what you're supposed to do the quiet time every day. I knew all about, like, staying away from secular music because Lynyrd Skynyrd backmasked stuff, and you shouldn't listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I knew that if you watch Dirty Dancing, it'd fill your mind with all kinds of evil. I knew about stuff we were supposed to stay away from. I knew about all the rules. I never knew about grace, about the gospel being that Jesus gave us what we did not deserve. We have people go through our baptism all the time who grew up in church and just now are beginning to understand the gospel for the first time, right? Look at your third thing there. Judas thought the salvation was political power. Jesus said, no, the motivation, the salvation we need is not primarily political. I mean, just look at it. Sadly, Christianity right now is most often defined as a political movement. And many Christians that I meet think that, you know, what America needs is more Christians in government. Let's get prayer back in schools. America needs to be saved, so we should elect Republicans. But you can't legislate transformed lives. Jesus did not come first as a political king. I'm not saying, by the way, that Christians should not be involved in politics. I'm just trying to show you that's what Judas wanted. What Judas wanted was a political solution to a problem that required a much deeper salvation. Yes, I want peace and prosperity on earth, which is why I haven't dedicated my life to helping us create a bigger military or even better laws. Yeah, that's great for some people, and I'm glad they're doing it, and we need them in government, but I'm telling you, the way I understand you create real peace and prosperity is doing exactly what we're doing here, and that is by preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is why I feel, and I hope you don't hear this the wrong way, I feel like what I'm doing, I would rather do this than be president of the United States of America. Because what I'm doing is something that laws and guns and peace accords and international meetings cannot do. It is the gospel that changes a heart. But Christians, most of us, think that the biggest problem in the world can be solved by electing the right people into office. No, it's solved by preaching the gospel. You see, the fourth thing, look at it. Judas thought that the rewards were riches. Jesus said, I'm the real treasure. When God disappoints you, when he doesn't answer your prayer, when bad things happen, you see, you're going to find out whether you got into this relationship where Jesus is the reward or whether you got in it so that he could give you something else. You're going to find out if you're serving God for God or whether you're expecting him to serve you. You think about Job. Think about that whole story. Job is a story that gets repeated over and over again. Because, you know, you get this conversation between Satan and God. And Satan says, well, of course Job serves you. Because you make him rich. Right? All you are is a means to an end for him. In fact, the way that Satan phrased it is, does Job serve you for nothing? I don't think so. He serves you because you are the best way to get the things he wants. And so the whole book of Job, 38 chapters from there to the end, is the story of how God took those things out of his life to show whether or not Job was serving God for God or whether he was serving him because he was a means to an end. That story gets repeated in each of your lives. I hope you realize that. Because he will sometimes withhold that blessing. He sometimes causes pain so that you can see whether or not Jesus is your reward or if you will sell Jesus off the way that you would sell a non-performing stock option off if it wasn't producing what you wanted it to produce. Here's a question you have to ask. If the only thing that you ever get in life is God, right? If he doesn't make you rich or successful, would you consider yourself really saved? What I mean is, do you feel like you got to have something else? You know, I was listening to the radio the other day, and I'm amazed just how much we always talk about the future, right? When so-and-so gets elected, then it's going to be great. When you get this job, it's going to be great. When you get married, when you have kids, when you get to retirement, it's going to be great. And the thing that it reveals is we never really think that it's great right now. It's always somewhere else that's great. If your life circumstances don't change one bit, would you consider yourself fully saved? Meaning, do you consider that everything is okay because you have Jesus and he is the reward? Judas represents the ultimate religious man. I want to be rewarded for my behavior, and when it doesn't happen, I'm angry and disappointed. Mary is the person who understands the gospel. I deserve nothing, but God has given me everything in Christ. Jesus paid it all, and all to him I owe. You see, when you feel bitter because you think I'm serving Jesus and he hasn't delivered, he hasn't helped me, realize at that moment you're acting like Judas and you're acting in a religious mindset. Religion says, I obey, therefore I will be accepted and rewarded. And you think, I'm going to obey, so bring on the rewards. The gospel says, no, you are accepted by the infinite, lavish sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That's your reward. Now, obey because you respond to Jesus in love. That's what Mary's doing. She's getting rid of all these things because she says it's just a response of love back to Jesus. He is the reward, and all I need is in him. You see, y'all, I look at the people throughout this story who betrayed Jesus, and what I see is that I am no better, not one bit. Judas betrayed Jesus for greed. And I think about how much I look at Jesus in my life as a means to an end. And I see that when I get bitter, when things don't work out, so I'm willing to compromise sometimes or depart from Jesus when I see a better opportunity toward the things that I think are important. As a pastor, you say, how does that happen? Well, as a pastor, what dominates my mind is succeeding. Right? And it's not that I ever turn around and like depart from Jesus and start worshiping Satan or some other god. It's that it just is not as important to me as pleasing Jesus as it is to figure out what I have to do to succeed. So I'll put pleasing Jesus on the back burner and even compromise my convictions if it will help me succeed. Judas. Right? It says the chief priests, they betrayed him because of envy. For me sometimes, I hear about some of the church being blessed and growing. I've told you this before. And the first impulse of my heart is not to rejoice that Jesus' kingdom's going forward. It's envy. Because I'm thinking, I wish, or, and I sometimes in my heart, if I'm honest with myself, I'm not even excited about it growing because I'm envious because I don't want them to be the big deal. I want me to be the big deal. That's the chief priest all over again. I don't want Jesus to succeed because I want to be important. You see, I look at Judas, and I don't see Judas as being somebody out there. I see Judas as being me. I am Judas. But I have repented. And you see, I trust in Christ to save me, and he is changing me. But here is my question. Is it possible that within our church there are people like Judas? You're involved in ministry. Judas was. You want Jesus. You follow Jesus. You believe in Jesus. But there's a couple of things that are true about you. First of all, you have expectations of Jesus, and because he has not met all those, you're bitter at him. The second thing that's not true of you, or that is true of you, is that you compromise your commitment to Jesus all the time. Your obedience goes like this right here. Because when Jesus and things are working out, you're excited, but then you trade him or you sell him. You see, sin, as Jesus defined it here, is ultimately betrayal. And that's how I want you to think about sin, betrayal. It is simply selling Jesus for something else. Have you honestly repented and given all of you to Jesus? There is no other option but full devotion to him. That's what Judas shows you. Because anytime you've got a price, we know what your identity is. We know you'll sell out, and Jesus just says, how long do I have to push you before I get you to do it? And you can see it in your life right now. Are you fully devoted to Jesus? That's the only way that you can walk with him. Right? Is he sufficient for you? You say, I get nothing else, nothing in reward. He's enough. And it's like marriage. If I went to my wife and on our wedding day, I said, sweetheart, I'm going to give you 90% of me. 96%, that's an A, right? 96, that's an A in college. You get A, you get the A portion of me. Do you think she'd be satisfied with 96% of me? No, because 96% of me means that I'm giving 4% to somebody else. That means every 100 nights I'm spending 4 of them with some other woman. You think it's okay with Jesus when you say, you got most of me. You got all these areas of my life, but not this one. And Jesus says, I understand your identity. I understand you have a price. I've got to be your only sufficient reward. You see, I want to show you how serious this is. Jesus looked at Judas, the very religious person, and said it'd be better for that man if he was never been, had never been born. Can you imagine that being heaven's estimation of you? Better that you'd never been born. Religion, listen, let me say this very clearly. This is not politically correct, but let me just say it. Religion sends people to hell. Religion sends more people to hell than irreligion does. Because religion convinces people that they can do just enough to make God happy, and they never encounter the gospel, which is total abandon to Jesus Christ. How do you get motivated to do that? Look at what Jesus did for you. You know, this interesting thing to me is that last scene where the guy runs away naked from the garden. You know, in the Garden of Eden, after man had sinned, there was an angel that was placed there with a flaming sword of God's justice. Man couldn't go back into that garden because otherwise he would be killed with the sword, the flaming sword. Jesus went back into the garden and took that sword into himself. So that having received God's justice in our place, I could be saved. If you look at Jesus, y'all, as an example that you can emulate, he'll discourage you. It'll crush you. You can never emulate that. But when you see Jesus as the one who died for you, if you look at it long enough, it will change your heart to where you say, he gave it all for me. Now I, like Mary, want to break this open and give it all back to him. That's what it means to become a follower of Jesus. Break yourself and just give all of yourself to him. Think about the cross. That's what I want to do right now. Okay, let me ask you to do this. Why don't you bow your heads with me for a moment? We're ending this with one more time here in this series, meditating on the cross by partaking of the Lord's table. Our deacons and some people they have asked to help them are coming in just a minute. They're going to get set up. But I wonder in this room right now, before we take this meditation on communion, I wonder if you, okay, not your neighbor, but you, have never fully given yourself to Jesus. If not, listen, this communion is not for you. This bread and this cup, that's something that believers are supposed to participate in. What you should do right now, listen, is give your heart to Jesus. And before we pass out the first element, I want to give you a chance to do that. Maybe you say, Jesus, I've been full of religion. I've never given myself to you. I've tried to be good enough to earn your approval. Now I realize that Jesus paid it all. And I receive what he has done in my place. Say that in your own words to him. Jesus, I receive all of you. I give you all myself. Father, I pray for those in this moment that are doing something even more than partaking of communion. They are opening up themselves to you. We give you thanks, Lord, for this incredible blessing you've given us in Jesus. As we meditate on that, as we put our minds around it now, change us, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Look up here with me for a moment, okay? Our deacons, people that are helping them, are going to pass out these elements. But if you prayed with me to receive Christ just now, all right, what I want you to do is I want you to, in your worship guide, pull out this white card. As others are, and you guys can go ahead and start passing these things out. You pull this white card out. And during this time, even more important, okay, much more important than you taking this bread and this cup is you taking a moment to fill this out for us, because we want to help you take those first steps of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. You got questions, you fill that out. You just fill it out, hold on to it. We'll tell you what to do with it in a minute. But prepare your heart, hold that bread and that cup, and I'll direct you here in a few minutes. Prepare your heart to think about the cross.